Hello everyone and welcome to the pilot edition of the This Is My Lockdown podcast. I personally haven't been excited about the term lockdown because since COVID began, it's only meant more restrictions and isolation from the ones I love. But I recently found out that lockdown is synonymous with a safe space, and that's what I hope to create with this podcast. A safe space to discuss mental health and well-being issues in these trying times. I hope that with the discussions we have over the next few months, we will be able to transform the narrative regarding mental illness and mental health in our communities. In this safe space, these discussions will inspire us to prioritize our well-being, realize the strengths and capabilities within our Black and Afro-Caribbean communities, and break the stigma surrounding mental health. I'm excited to go on this journey with you. My name is Angela Kuma, and this is my lockdown. We're proudly sponsored by the National Lotteries and the This Is My City brand. Okay, so we're going to start on today's discussion, and this is quite personal to me because I know a lot of people who have drug and alcohol addictions, and especially during lockdown, we've heard that there's just been a surge in drug and alcohol misuse and addiction rates. And today to discuss this with me, I have on set Vanessa Kelly. Hi, Vanessa.
Hi.
And Terry Gilling. Hi,
hi,
Terry.
Hi, Angela.
Yeah. So I'll let Vanessa introduce herself and let Terry introduce herself as well.
So yeah, thank you very much, Angela, for inviting us here today. It's quite exciting. This is a topic which is very personal to both of us in so many ways. My name is Vanessa Kelly. I have a brand called This Is VLK. I'm a public speaker. I'm a motivational speaker and have been doing so. But more importantly, I'm a social educator. And what that basically means is that I touch on some of the issues that really impact our community. But my kind of key interest, which I've been talking about for actually nearly 8 years now, is drugs and alcohol and what impact that has on absolutely everybody, young people, old people, but primarily young people. I do a lot of work in schools and engaging with young people as well. Cherry, do you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, hi. Thank you for having us, Angela. I'm Cherry Gillings. I have a coaching practice called Inner Space Coaching. And I work from a transformational base, which is that change happens from the inside out. And that's the only place that lasting change can occur. So my approach to addiction and recovery and mental health and well-being is that there's a space within each and everybody that's always well, always whole, always perfect, always complete. And that there's something about engaging with the body that we have that enables us to kind of touch that space and to notice the difference between the mind chatter, the noise, and then the desires that we have, and then the place where we're whole and complete. And that's the work that I do. So I've been working in the addiction sector since 2003. It's kind of what I've been doing with most of my career. And I love the work.
Yeah.
I love the work.
I know, right?
But you know what? We have this lived experience as well. And one of the things for me is that if you look at most recovery communities, most recovery conversations, most journeys from, you know, addiction to recovery, you're not likely to see many Black people showing up in that sector. Mm-hmm. What you see is a lot of white men, a lot of white women, and actually what you also experience is a lot of racism within that. Yeah. So it's really helpful to have this conversation with us having this conversation, right?
Yeah, most definitely. I think one of the things, even just about drugs and alcohol, and then even pairing it with COVID-19, is that a lot of it's happened behind closed doors.
Yeah.
And now we're about to break it down. Literally. Yeah. We're about to break it down.
Yeah. So drug and alcohol conversations, addiction conversations are new. We've had them over and over and over again. But we've never had them during COVID. I mean, I've never had to sit down and have one of these conversations. So Vanessa, tell us what drug and alcohol addiction is, first of all.
Yeah, so for me to kind of explain that, I'm going to go back a little bit more and I'm going to explain what is a drug.
Okay.
Yeah, I do these talks and I kid you not, the surprising things of people that don't really understand what is a drug. Now, all drugs, whether we're talking about legal or illegal drugs, every single drug is essentially a poison or a toxin. Mm. Okay, a small amount will make you hyper or make you active, causes a change in the body, more of the same drug will actually make the person drowsy, asleep, acts as a sedative, call that a depressant. Mm. And then too much of the same drug too fast can cause an overdose and kill you. All drugs work in exactly the same way. So on the spectrum of whether it's paracetamol to heroin, with alcohol, whatever drug we're talking about, they all work in exactly the same way. You'll have stimulants, mm-hmm. depressants, and then hallucinogenics. And it's then how the body changes and is then impacted by that. Now, one of the things that I'm always really clear about is that I'm not here to tell anybody to stop taking their insulin. Like, it's not that. I'm literally going to really make you understand that. It's not, and when we put drugs in whatever category, it's important that we understand that some drugs are necessary.
Yeah.
So it's not that I talk about good drugs, bad drugs, drugs. I don't know. No, it's like understanding what is a drug, what essentially it actually is, which is a poison or a toxin, but then knowing that certain drugs controlled, provided to you in an environment which we know is going to help, you know, heal the body, soothe the body, make an improvement, then we understand that there's actually basically there's a benefit with them, but it really does have to be controlled. Now, you mentioned the idea around what is the idea around addiction, and what's really important to understand is that the body and the mind, it's two, we're all a part of the same, but there's two separate addictions that are effectively happening. Yeah. And interestingly, when we think about the addiction on the body, it's the fact that all the vitamins and all the minerals and anything positive in the body has been eaten up. It's been burnt away by the drugs. Mm. And then effectively what you're left inside the body is the residual particles of that drug. It doesn't go anywhere. Unfortunately, our livers were never designed for drugs and alcohol, designed for it. So we don't know how, our liver doesn't know how to break it down. And as you probably remember in school, what your liver doesn't break down, it stores. So then a lot of people really don't understand that sometimes you can literally take a drug one time and have a lifetime of addiction. Yeah. Do you want to add anything onto that, Jerry?
Only that what we can see today is that people are in fix-it mode, people are in relief-seeking mode, and there's something quite natural and very human about being in relief-seeking mode, right?
Yeah.
And that, you know, drugs and the use of substances has been here since the beginning of time, and that, you know, the context in which the substance use occurs is really significant. Mm-hmm. So back in the day, you know, the substance misuse was associated with ritual, associated with contacting, you know, higher realms and other forces, mm-hmm. and kind of visiting and seeking solutions for individuals and for community. Now it's become part of this individuation. Yeah. Now it's become about a loss of connection, and I need to feel better.
Yeah.
And I can't make the connections. And of course, COVID has really, that's been the impact of COVID, hasn't it? It's been the disconnection and the isolation.
Yeah.
I think that Gabor Mate has got a beautiful way of describing what addiction is, and he says, you know, any behavior that we experience temporary relief from, but that causes us long-term painful consequences that we can't stop, that's addiction. So people are addicted to their phones, they're addicted to work, they're addicted to their computers, they're addicted to porn and gambling and drugs and alcohol and what have you, and it's like, you know, the wisdom to notice the difference, huh?
And I find it interesting that you mentioned that you can take a drug once and be addicted to it the rest of your life. And I think a lot of the time we have the impression that you take the drug and it goes out somehow of your body, but it stays. And I don't think that's a narrative that is stressed enough, honestly. Like, I don't even think they taught it enough to me while I did my degrees, that it stays. Like, I mean, I'm a clinical psychologist, and we talk about being addicted to a drug, and we try to measure a timeline and how many, I mean, what it gives you, the feelings you get from using it, how long you've been using it, if you've developed a dependency. But nobody really talks about the fact that you use it once and then it stays for a lifetime. So if you could just go.
So I would only say that that certain drugs work on the particular pathway, isn't it? The dopamine reward pathway.
Yeah.
And the drugs that kind of activate that in a massive way, mm-hmm. are obviously your stimulants like crack cocaine and methamphetamine. Now, they're the ones, crystal meth, they're the ones that people get. They will speak about being addicted to straight away because the dopamine is so high, the glutamate released in the brain is so high. That's it. We're going for that over and over and over again.
Yeah.
We'd be mistaken, though, if we said you're addicted for life.
Yeah.
Because look, I'm here. She's here.
Yeah.
You know? It's not true, right?
Yeah.
So you can become hooked very quickly.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that you're hooked for life. And that's kind of some of the stories, some of the mythology that's out there about, okay, once you're an addict, you're always an addict. Mm. Not so.
Yeah.
Absolutely not so. So we do have to tell a different narrative. We also have to talk about, you know, the drive that kind of is expressed through the desire to keep using that thing, like what is missing in your life that this makes sense to you, and stop making people feel bad for their choices, but actually get to the why the pain, let's talk about that.
Which leads on really well into understand that you've got physical addiction and understanding what your mental addiction was. So when people actually don't realise is that a lot of uses of drugs actually happen on the basis of to suppress trauma.
Yeah.
So then when you're suppressing trauma, the idea is that you're not then confronting what the trauma actually is.
Yeah.
And then that confront is then what builds up, and then you use that as an outlet to suppress other traumas, even more traumas. And one of the things that actually happen in your mind as you're using is that it's creating these kind of black spots in your memory bank. It creates these kind of black areas of when you're under the influence and you are, under that depressant stage of whatever the drug of choice of whatever it is. But that mental impact that it has means that you're not making those correct decisions. It affects your intelligence, your attention span, how you communicate with people. And then people don't realise that then if more traumas happening on top of that, people end up in a lot more, mental issues or mental considerations that they probably didn't think that they would ever be faced with. But then you're not dealing with yourself without any other influences that are changing while you're behaving in that way. It's quite interesting that a lot of people tend to not really understand why somebody would choose drugs as an answer. And you've mentioned it kind of already, the fact of that, just that instant relief point, that instant idea of just to release whatever is that trauma, that feeling, that problem that happens at that point. And I think that's really important to understand.
Fundamentally, we've got an intolerance of feelings. So we are, and if you think of the culture we kind of live in, it's like we promote happiness as the go-to ideal, and anything that's contrary or counter to that we want to avoid. And of course drugs and alcohol becomes the avoidance, a very simple go-to avoidance. But there's something, isn't there, about us kind of even just having this conversation in this way, saying you need all of the colors to paint with. You know, it's not just about the yellow and the orange and the red. You know, it's like you need all of the colours. It's like, it seems to me that that's what we find intolerable, what we believe to be intolerable, is what moves us towards seeking for something outside of ourselves.
Seems
important.
And I think, I suppose, for just our own individual backgrounds and why it is so important, we've come from, I think our communities haven't enabled us to kind of always be so transparent and open about drug usage, and just kind of acknowledging when it has become an issue, when it has not become an issue. Drug usage doesn't generally just become an issue when you have to go and like knock on the door of the rehab center and go, hey, I need help. The reality is that so many people are living in their addiction and they're still going to work. They're still getting up. And it was quite interesting, I'd like to say my drug issues or my drug problems happened when I was a very, very young. So it wasn't ever identified as a drug issues. It was more of a rebellion of rules and kind of to break the rules. But sometimes the rules indirectly haven't always been there. To kind of let you know, well, the rules against taking drugs, as opposed to, breaking the rules just to be a rebel and stuff. There wasn't that there. So a lack of education for me, I never understood what was going to happen when I took my first line of coke, for instance, I'll never forget it. I didn't understand what was going to happen. I didn't understand why, the environments of what that all was going to lead to. And I can pinpoint that exact moment and just the stages of what I went through over kind of like a 2-3 year period was just like, it's phenomenal to think how something as a substance, and that choice by not being educated to know what the impact potentially could be and how that was going to change. Yeah. And I suppose, you know, for everybody, you've got to have that point of, okay, what now? You know, what is my why? What is my reason to either stop, to change, to want more and to be empowered about that? And I think one of my greatest achievements is the fact of I do these talks and I go to schools and I impact so much on the basis of know why you're saying no, know why your impact is that, know why you've got that choice to make and know how difficult it is actually going to be, but know why you're saying it. Yeah. I think earlier on in our school days, you'd have this conversation of just say no. And you were never really told the reason why to say no. Yeah. So then you have this idea of that, well, hold on, my uncle's smoking weed and my mum tells me to go and make her a martini and lemonade. And if I take a little sip at 7, it's completely fine because, you know, at Christmas, I'll get to taste some Baileys and stuff and things like that. Yeah. And automatically, we're really educated around our environment that it's all right to drink, it's all right to smoke weed, it's all right to do party drugs on the weekend as long as you still get up and go to work. But what are you really suppressing? And I think my biggest confront was to understand what I was actually suppressing, ignoring the reasons about my current why, and know that there was a bigger why that I was kind of like going out for.
And I find it interesting that you talk about education, about what the effects were on you, because we have this generic education where you go to school, they teach you what drugs are, don't do them, this is what happens, this is why it happens, broken homes. Like, you know, we have a generic list, but nobody actually goes into the why. Like, as you said, like, nobody actually really wants to talk about what is going on underneath. And I mean, if you could both tell us a bit more about your story, go a little more into it.
Quite interestingly, my first kind of experience of drugs, and this is what I tell to kids in school, never forget, I was at a family party, my uncle's there, he's got this big spliff in his mouth, I'm like, uncle, what are you doing, what's that? And he said, big people business. And that was it. I didn't get anything else. I didn't have a conversation with anybody else. Yeah. And when you're a child, you've got adults telling you, oh, you know, you should grow up and, you know, stop behaving like a child. And then when you start wanting to do adult things, these adult things you're actually not allowed to do because you're a child. So it was really quite confusing for me. Started selling weed when I was in school. Went to an all-girls school at that. It was interesting. I became a product of my environment. Okay. I went to a girls' school, and because I was from Handsworth.
Okay.
And it's quite interesting. You end up being a product of your environment. So everybody from Handsworth knows where to get weed from, right? You just automatically say, it's like, yeah, let's get some weed. And, you know, I used to sell weed in school. And then it was really quick. I mean, so quick. You can't be around certain people and not think that, you know, the ganja man isn't going to have other drugs because you can't, you know, it doesn't work like that. And it was just so quick. So my friend groups changed. The people that I was around changed. I didn't go to school. I actually left my mom's house. So it was so difficult. I was fighting against all of these different kind of like situational demons. But a lot of it was kind of being drawn to me because of the drugs and alcohol, because you were going to be out late at night, you were going to talk to some random stranger on a bus, and then all of a sudden, you know, like, yeah, you got weed, I got weed, the things that I would do, it was nuts. But I remember taking my first line of cocaine at 15. I was at a party after going to a nightclub that I wasn't supposed to be at. Hey, it's all coming out. But reality was that I could get away with these things, and so I did it. It was what adults were doing. And it was such an experience that, as much as I was so scared, surviving it made me excited to do more. And that was the weirdest thing, because people said to you that you'd die from taking certain drugs, and then I didn't. So I was like, was I then exempt, you know? And so then, talking a while back now, like nearly 20-odd years ago, it's showing my age. But no, but I say this, but then, you know, the party scene and the club scene of taking pills and taking multiple drugs and just being around that, we'd take pills on a Tuesday because there was nothing else to do, you know? And you could get pills for 50 pence if you knew the right person.
Oh, wow.
You know? Okay. So it's so frightening now to really understand just where I was at and to come out of it, you know, and to be able to look back on it and go, wow, that was really the environment, you know. But then I can see of, you know, I'm very grateful that there were certain circumstances and situations that I never saw. So up until I can, you know, there's certain things I just never saw. I never saw anybody OD, but I heard the stories. I never saw anybody do that. I didn't hear the stories, you know. So I kind of always knew that there was always a time I'd be like, yeah, I'm ready to go home now. And kind of take my way out of it. But there were so many potential circumstances and situations that I could have gone through that would have made matters so much worse. But it took other conversations with other people for me to understand I didn't need to live my life like that. So it makes it a little bit different. So Cherry,
it's always great having, like, I always tell people that it's sometimes you need other people to point things out to you, because we're always looking at things through a tainted glass, and until somebody says that you need to change this or this needs to be done, we never realize the faults within us. So I mean, I really like that it took other conversations with other people to get to that point, and that's amazing. I think, I mean, that's what we're trying to normalize, you know, those conversations, being able to talk about those things and not hide behind, you know, all the trauma and the drugs and the, I'm a product of my environment, so this is who I am and I can't change it, and just be open to talking to other people about these experiences. So I think that's amazing. Awesome. Cherry?
So I'm listening to, you know, Vanessa tell her story, and I'm like, oh, you know what? You sounded like fun girl. There was nothing fun about my story. I'm like, wow, there was some fun in that, you know, there was something like. So, you know, when you think about a crackhead, you think about the people outside up and down the road, making up noise, making up bear trouble, don't business, don't, no manners. That was me. So, and I didn't start there, of course. I used to use crack cocaine, kind of recreationally with my friends, you know, and like I lived, it was in Toxteth, and I don't even want to talk about some things that we got up to, but like, so it was kind of recreational then. And then, so some stuff happened where I'd been looking for my birth father, right? And I discovered that my birth father had passed away before I'd found him. So my head fell off, my house got burgled, and I'm going to dance college in London. And I have to leave my daughter with my mum so I can go and pursue this kind of thing, this dance thing. And I last a couple of months in London before I start using, like, all of the time. And my heart is, like, in a million pieces, but crack cocaine, that's it. It's the answer of answers. And I'm in it and I don't care, and I fall fast and I fall deep and I don't stop. Like, funny things like learning how to shoplift.
Yeah,
they're the funny things that I remember. Like, I had to learn how to do that. Like, can you imagine?
Not now.
So, you know, so that was where my life went anyway. So a year later, I end up connected to some really dodgy stuff. And I come back and I go to jail for 7 years. 7 year sentence, but I served 3.5.
Okay.
So this is like, I come out in 1999. So it's a long time ago now. But you see, when my sister tells the story and it's all like, oh, yeah, we did this and oh, yeah, we did that. I'm like, no, it was dark and it was dangerous. And the amazing thing is that, you know, you come out of those situations and, you know, you end up at college and uni, you go for therapy and what have you. And this counsellor, this Gestalt practitioner, she says to me, you were a statistic waiting to happen. Now, when she said that, I was all like super offended. Like, who's this white woman telling me that I'm a statistic waiting to happen? But actually, she was really accurate, because she understood about adverse childhood experience before anybody was talking about adverse childhood experience. So, like, that's the kind of the point that I kind of know about my life, is that actually there were these things that happened back then that they, like, what were the odds that your life was ever going to go in any other direction? Now, that's not somebody saying, I'm a product of my environment. That's saying, actually, the statistics bear this out.
Yeah.
Four or more of these things, and you're, like, likely to shorten your lifespan by 20 years. 20 years, you know. 4 times more likely to end up in addiction. 10 times more likely to end up in prison. However many times more likely to suffer from conditions like lung cancer, heart disease. Now, what I understand is that we are still not so good as a community about speaking about adverse childhood experiences.
Yeah.
Even acknowledging that, you know what, leaving your kids over there so you could come here created an adverse condition in the kid's life. And we get it. But like, let's talk about it. Let's stop hiding. You know, so that's the thing. So that's how I understand my addiction journey. But like, it's also how I understand my recovery, right? Mm. You know, we talk about, one of you's mentioned in this day, generational trauma. And I've been speaking about, what about generational resilience then? Because if trauma can be passed on in the genes, guess what? Resilience can come down the genes as well. Right now saying, look at me, I'm evidence of resilience in the genes. You know, I could have dead a long time. But here I am, by the grace of God and whatever other forces are, you know, kind of supporting me, you know.
It's so funny that you say, I love your story, because I say to kids, like, I have a really boring drug story. It's really dry. Like, seriously, because I'm here to talk about it. I kid you not. I know drug stories, like, you know. I make a joke of it and stuff, and I've shortened it down a little bit. And yeah, there were some really bad times and stuff. But if people were actually to look at it compared to, you know, I know it's nuts, because I know a 21-year-old girl who was in recovery, and she had like 3 weeks clean, and had some coke after, you know, a couple of weeks and died.
Yeah.
You know, I know I've buried people on the basis of the fact that they literally, it was 6 months, my nephew's dad was in a hospital with no identification for 6 months, so they couldn't bury him to tell his next of kin. And eventually when they figured it all out, because he was missing from the shelters and XYZ, the list of conditions he had, they couldn't put it down to one thing on his birth, on his death certificate. So we talk about and it's so interesting that I talk about it so openly because I was able to confront so much of my issues and traumas at those times. But the reality is, when I actually really look at it, the experiences, the danger, the so many other things could have come out of it. It would have been 10 times worse. That to be able to kind of sit back and go, now I use those experiences to answer those questions. Kids have actually said to me, you know, but miss, I do want to try smoking weed. And I says, but even if I tell you all of the things that will happen to you about it, what I want you to know is that the long-term effects are going to outweigh any short-term effects, right? And it's about knowing how to have that conversation. Be upfront, be honest, talk about the fact of, you know, can you afford your habit? Can you actually afford it? I found it really expensive.
Yeah.
You know, a 15-year-old trying to get a bag of weed, but then you ended up selling weed to straight away, I'm a drug dealer. Yeah. Then the consequences that actually come off the back of that, didn't finish school, didn't go to college. My first job was working in McDonald's. All I ever did was do enough work to have enough money to buy enough drugs, to go buy enough alcohol, to go out raving. Didn't have nothing to show for anything. You get to 25, 26, you're like, whoa, hold on a second, I ain't got nothing, you know. Why haven't I got nothing? And it's literally the amount of what do you want to get out of it. And I think for me it was like, I know that I'm on destination greatness, so this wasn't gonna help me do that. So it's interesting.
This is a very interesting conversation, because coming from a different background, I'm from Ghana, and this is very hush-hush. Nobody talks about the drugs. If you see somebody walking on the street looking dirty or looking like a crackhead, then that person was on drugs. Any mental health issue is suddenly connected with drugs, you know. And we don't really have these conversations, but I never really got entrenched into it until I started to like volunteer in rehab and started to hear people's stories. And there's so many people who do not know or do not care or have no idea that people are using drugs, like doctors use drugs before they go into surgery. And I was like, oh my gosh, no. And you talk about being able to cope and, you know, just, I don't even know the words to use, like suppressing all that is going on within, like understanding the how and the why and the long-term effects. And these people know the long-term effects. I mean, you don't have to be black and deprived and not have money. You've talked about the statistics and then that you are... you'd be a product of your environment and what is going on around you as well. But people don't understand that it spans professions, it spans class, mm-hmm. it spans, it's not just...
Drugs don't discriminate.
Yeah.
That's the one thing that I've learned. Drugs do not discriminate.
Yeah.
I have had conversations and sat next to, doctors, lawyers, people who were very well off, got a lot of money.
Yeah.
I don't think there's not any cultural groups that I've ever come across that haven't ever impacted or had a problem or known, obviously, about drugs.
Yeah.
And I know all around the world it's just different types of drugs that just impact people more. And quite interestingly, just to give you a fact, the one drug that kills more people, damages more lives, affects more families, impacts the NHS more than any other drug, all the other drugs combined and all put together, is alcohol.
Mm.
Yeah, it's legal.
Yeah.
You can buy it in Morrison's, Sainsbury's, Tesco, Asda, corner shops.
Yeah.
You ask a four-year-old, about certain things, and they can tell you, "Well, that's beer, and this is wine." And the reality is that we're, society and our environments and things that are happening around us, it's all a product to that kind of end goal of like, well, if you're just happy for the right now, and whatever makes you happy for the right now, then hey, we'll figure out tomorrow later on. But the reality is that suppressing that feeling or not confronting exactly what's supposed to be going on, and that's when you're going to get into problems. And I think the one thing our Prime Minister probably should have actually done at the beginning of a lockdown was taken away alcohol away from everybody as well at the same time. And then, some of the statistics that we've looked at and we've seen and stuff has been absolutely nuts.
Yeah. I mean, I find that interesting because I was reading and I found out that alcohol retailers were put down as essential services. And I didn't know that. I mean, I did see the shops open, but until I started to read about just this discussion we're going to have, I was like, why are they essential?
It's quite interesting because just alcohol, alcohol's been around for a very long time and in controlled amounts. And this is something I tell the kids at school, right? So the government put this big sign on there saying 2 units, recommended daily allowance. 2 units, yeah? Now, interestingly, to really understand how your body gets affected, there's 3 stages of how your body works called stimulation, depression, and pain, okay? Small amount stimulates, more of the same, can act as a sedative, put you to sleep, then effectively more again, can act as an overdose, worst case scenario, kill you. But the stages of that really is your body going from stimulation, depression, and pain, right?
Mm.
2 units of alcohol leave you kind of at the beginning of stimulation, right?
Okay.
2 units. Now, the average person would have 1 glass of wine, 2 units. 1 beer, 2 units. A double shot, 2 units. That's one drink.
Yeah.
That's it. And it literally is just one drink.
Yeah.
So when people have this idea, it's like, have a couple of pints, over the limit. A couple of glasses of wine, over the limit. Now, the reality is that, the government have done another test. They know exactly how much your body can cope with and can deal with and that's 2 units.
Yeah.
Anything more than that, they kind of throw their hands up and go, hey, now you're on your own.
Yeah.
But they've been really clear to say the recommended daily allowance is 2 units. The average person that's having a bottle of wine with their 14 units finishes that in a night. If not 2 to 3 bottles of wine if you're in friends, and then automatically it becomes such a social thing that counting units has been totally just dismissed to really understand the impact of what those units are actually going to do to you,
So that's partly what's happened in COVID.
Yeah.
Is that whereas people might have gone out, drank less, come home in a cab, what have you, they've drank more because they're at home and they feel safe at home. So not only is the frequency increased, but also the amount that people are drinking is increased. So, the consumption is, 10, 12, 14 units in one go. And instead of that being like maybe like a one-off, a binge kind of event, it's reoccurring through the week now. And like the risks to people's health, the increased damage to their mental health.
Yeah.
You know, that's a real thing right now, isn't it? You know, that's a real some people's drinking has become so bad during lockdown that they're finding that they can't stop drinking, that they need to drink early in the morning. They're finding they've got physical withdrawal symptoms. And I think those things are really, like, we need to talk about those things, right? Yeah. People need to know, actually, here's what you do with that. You can go and get some help with that. Yeah. And, you know, the data is fascinating. You know, if you drank significantly before lockdown, your drinking's gotten worse.
Yeah.
If drinking was a little bit something for you before lockdown, you've likely to increase your drinking.
Yeah.
But if your drinking was not, kind of take it or leave it, you were much more likely to have stopped drinking altogether during the lockdown. You didn't see it as a reason to go, oh, well, you know,
yeah,
let's do what we can. It was really interesting, like, you know, some of that information is missing from the data, isn't it? Like, what's the personality type, what's going on, what's that person's usual kind of rule and obligation kind of pathway, you know, how compliant are they generally. Yeah, there's definitely more going on. The data is really interesting.
Yeah, and I read a couple of articles, and I have a couple of them printed out as well, but I'm a researcher, so I like to read a lot, but I picked the easy statistics. So I found this in The Independent, and it said in February, 10.8% of the English population engaged in what is classified as the standard alcohol use survey as higher risk drinking. By April, this figure had skyrocketed to 19.4% and remained at 19% in June, and we're in October, so that figure may have tripled by now.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that is scary.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what's more scary for me? Just because with alcohol, just people think it's legal. Because people think it's legal, they think it's safe. So they actually really forget just the damage that is happening to their bodies.
Yeah.
And then there's always, it's quite interesting, you know, I used to have a bit of a running joke when I used to party quite a lot. And my running joke was that if I didn't get sick, I didn't have a good night.
Yeah.
I literally, that was the benchmark of, I threw up, so I had a really good night, right? But sometimes this idea of, you know, the go-to answer to my stressful day, or the go-to answer because somebody stepped on my toe, or the go-to answer because I can't afford the bills, is this glass of wine. It's become such a generalized answer to problems. It's actually just really quite hurtful that people can see that as the answer, you know. I find it, especially with alcohol, that it's a slow killer. And that's probably another thing that people don't really identify with. Alcohol causes 7 different types of cancer. A lot of people say to me, oh, I'm trying to lose weight. I say, are you still drinking alcohol? They go, yes. Well, those dead calories, you're never going to lose any weight, right? The people don't even realize that there's calories in alcohol. So it goes back to a lot of misconceptions about what people do or don't know about drugs and alcohol, and what people decide just to understand for themselves, you know? And I think it's very much, you know, nobody has a measure at home and decides that they're actually going to pour exactly their recommended daily allowance and stick within that. So straight away, you know, you pour as how the glass fills up, right? And if the glass is then full, how big is the glass? You know, so it's interesting. But I think, you know, with this, with what's happened around COVID, there isn't then that separation of then not drinking in front of the children, not, you know, is it just going to be on Friday night, or well, every day, you know, what we're doing tomorrow, that groundhog
day,
have
to get up for work in the morning,
blah, whatever. So you end up really kind of making, you know, it more convenient for yourself now that you're at home, you know. I really feel that, along with, you know, the government talked about, you know, let's ban chocolate being sold in special offers. We should do the exact same for alcohol. Don't take 25% off 6 bottles.
Those are discussions we don't want to have.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to hear it.
Yeah. But reality, I think, is if there was a bigger understanding of just the impact of alcohol alone to the body, forgetting the fact that a lot of people are not then just drinking alcohol, because if you're a heavy drinker, the chances are
heavy smoker.
There could be the fact of you're taking any other, you know, medications. Now if you're on antidepressants and then you drink alcohol, now we're doing into cocktails of drugs, and now it then tends to start being something else. automatically, when alcohol stops giving you that feeling, you're going to progress onto other drugs. Yeah. And it's then that everybody, you know, everybody's out for that high. Everybody's out for that high. So then there's something that sometimes, you know, it's not guaranteed, it's not always, yeah, but there's this idea that if you don't get that high anymore, then
you need more.
You need more. Mm.
So that's what people do. Yeah, that's how they progress into dependency and addiction, isn't it? Yeah. It's not always the switch to, because people will do that as well, right? Mm-hmm. They'll say that and then nobody wants to talk about it again. Yeah. And it's like, you know, you're right in the terms of, you get dependent by building a tolerance and then you need more of, you know?
Yeah. And well, these are conversations nobody wants to have. I can personally say that nobody wants to hear that you shouldn't go beyond your limit and that there's a limit and that it can progress to something worse. And these are conversations we don't want to have because, as Vanessa said, drinking a glass of wine when you are tired or stressed or upset and now with lines blurred because you're not going to work so anybody upsets you, it's there's bound to be a lot of like ripple effects, and I'm really worried about the effects that are going to be shown in the next 3 to 4 months, given that we're still in COVID. We don't know the progression or what's going on. I mean, lockdown, no lockdown, are we still stuck in it, are we out of it, and things are going to get worse.
So look at the calls to domestic violence refuges, to women's aid and what have you, and that's one of the consequences that's come out of people being in lockdown, alcohol consumption having gone up, people being in close proximity to each other and not able to get away. Like that's another one of those tangible facts that you can see is in play when people are locked in with intoxicating substances and each other and no means of kind of discharging the dynamics that they usually carry. Yeah. So oftentimes if you can go to work, you know, your role, who you think you are, is in play. Yeah, but now my role, who I think I am, is not in play, and I'm stuck indoors with whosoever I'm stuck indoors, and all of those different dynamics. And this, you know, it's not okay to not be okay. Like, that's the fundamental flaw, isn't it?
Yeah.
The fundamental flaw is that it's not okay to be bored. Therefore, I need something to fix my boredom. It's not okay to be scared. I need something to fix my scared. Yeah. It's not okay to be sad. I need something to fix my sad. Like, that's really where the work is. So we can. We can say, well, you know, the drugs and the alcohol, but they are symptomatic of what we will refuse to tolerate in our emotional kind of landscape. And, you know, for me, that's the work over and over again. That's the work. Like, it will show up like this. Yes, it will show up in so many ways.
Yeah.
Like, if we were talking about pornography, like, can you imagine how much the porn traffic has gone up? How much more expense has been spent on those kind of facilities? But we're not. We're talking about these very obvious things like drugs and alcohol, and it's very easy, isn't it, to kind of demonize that.
Yeah.
But actually, let's look at what other kind of self-harming mechanisms are at play here, you know, and what other community harming mechanisms are at play, and what are we doing to kind of... I'm breathing on. I am
it's hard
to breathe and do the work because that's where the work is.
Yeah, there's so many conversations to unpack in this. Like, I have like 10 different things to, like, I want us to talk about in detail because there's just so much to unpack. But I mean, going forward, given the situation, seeing what we're facing right now, knowing that we're not getting out of it any soon, and we've talked about the fact that the effects are going to be bad and they're long term and they don't just end with us, they end with the people, they affect the people around us, they affect our jobs, they affect our finances. It's an expensive behavior. It is. And we have to fund it, but we don't have the money. People are losing their jobs. People have to stay at home now because they can't go out to work, or life is just not, there's no normal. There's no normal anymore. What we used to know as normal is different. Going forward, you've talked about help being available. Can you talk about a bit into the work you are doing now on a more online basis? Because, I mean, we have to face the fact that there is a new normal and we're going to have to be doing everything online. How are you providing your services with the different organizations that you run to let people know that help is available?
Yeah, so thankfully, digital world, as much as I've been so frightened for it, It is definitely a new world, a new world. But thankfully, I was actually able to do some of my webinars that I would normally deliver in schools, that I would normally go to school. So I was able to deliver them as webinars instead, I should say. So it was literally just transferring how we do what we do and just being digital. Quite interesting, and what we've talked about is whether we're dealing with kids, and I mean, I do workshops for like year five, year six, all the straight through up to secondary schools, university, you know, parents and stuff. It's quite interesting that now, where we're living right now, the drugs that kids are taking, and I have to say kids, young people, it's so heavily influenced by what they hear, what they see, what they can just get their hands available on. And this is the point that I kind of just wanted to refer back to a little bit. Alcohol is definitely the option and the hand and go-to drugs.
Yeah.
But I kid you not, I was having a conversation and it was a group of kids that were bored, and because they couldn't get any alcohol, because they couldn't get any weed, one of them decided, oh, hey, we can get access to LSD instead. So it's so crazy, and my mind, you've never drank alcohol and you've just skipped like, it feels like, you know, there isn't any like baseline point anymore, which takes me back to like my original point. I never just talk about drugs being legal or illegal. Mm-hmm. Drugs are all drugs, and they just work slightly differently, take more in impacts, because unfortunately just what's available and what's being pushed out there now is so much more readily available. You can have it posted to your front door.
Yeah. Amazon.
Hello. It's apps. You can literally have, you know, all different types of drugs posted through your front door, you know. I've had conversations with kids, when I have to go back and do research, then you know, right, that there's this new stuff coming out. So, you know, the fact of purple drink, you know, like the mixing of codeine and lemonade.
Yes.
And just if I can't get, you know, and just mimicking or trying to kind of just have content for the gram to say that, well, this is what it was about, just for that answer to their boredom, or that answer to that, why can't we just be chilling at home, you know?
Yeah.
Why can't we just do that? So for me, I can't stop doing what I'm doing, whether it's the fact of, I was lucky I got to be in school for a couple of days last week, but I have to still keep on doing my webinars. The fact that this is our first podcast, we've kind of decided that we're going to need to do something more with this, because like you said, this conversation has to be unboxed and unpacked.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm going to continue to keep on doing what I do, just to talk. Because I like doing that a lot. But yeah, you know, I want to continue to have these conversations with young people, with adults, you know, because it is just education, you know.
Yeah.
A lot of young people do not realise that our bodies are so unique and so different, that how you react is not how I will react.
Yeah.
How your body reacts is maybe different to how my body will react. So the gamble that you are taking right now, every time you put that poison or toxin into your body, is literally that gamble. But you know, when you've got something different to live for, though, you know, it gives you a purpose that then makes it. So for me, it's not just about, you know, education about the drugs and alcohol. It's, let me tell you that this is an amazing life that you have.
Yeah.
You won, you know, there was millions and millions and millions of swimmers and you won one, right? Yeah. You won one. You're a winner. You're a winner. You're a winner, you know? And I tell the kids that, and I make it, you know, we laugh about it, but I make it so that they realize that their life was not here by accident. Mm-hmm. They are not here because of anything other than they have a greatness that's over their life, and they've got to be that better version of that.
Yeah.
And drugs and alcohol, you know, have a way of diluting who you are and impacting on that purpose, so you do not become the version that you are intended to be, you know. And so with all my drug talks and that, I have that conversation on, find your why to know why you don't want to take drugs. Find your why, so that you know why this is a life that you don't know what to do. Because I can tell you the outcome. I can tell you what's going to happen that way.
Yeah.
But you can plan it and be different and make it that way. So,
Yeah. Terry?
So my coaching practice is totally online and over the telephone now.
Okay.
Whereas before, I used to do face-to-face stuff. And that's fine. And, you know, majoritively my clients are coming through like Instagram and or kind of word of mouth stuff as well. But I think similar to what kind of Vanessa is saying is the work that I do is really about pointing people in a different direction. It's kind of saying, okay, let's have a look at what the sticking points are and whatever the problems are. Like, that's like, let's do that work. Let's not be afraid to have those conversations. And then also, let's have a look at what a well-lived life looks like. Mm. Yeah. So what are your values? So you'll probably be familiar with acceptance and commitment therapy, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, it's the most simplest tool. But, you know, even if we just focus on behavior for a moment and think about, okay, what's important to me, what really matters in my life, is what I'm about to do right now going to move me towards what's important, or is it going to take me away from what's important? It's a very simple distinction, but because we're running on autopilot most of the time, we're never really slowing down to notice. So there's an invitation, even as you're hearing this podcast, to take a breath and just notice. Am I moving towards what I want more of in my life, to what's important to me in my life, or am I moving away? And that's it. That's the wonderful thing about ACT. Like, there's all kinds of gorgeous stuff all around it as well. Yeah. But in its key essence, it's that. Yeah. Do I know what satisfaction is for me? Do I know what lights me up like a Christmas tree? Do I know what floats my boat? Mm. Do I know, Grant Cardone asked this awesome question the other day. Like, what would you walk over broken glass for? Who would you walk over broken glass for? Yeah?
Yeah.
And that's it. Like, because, you know, to make a decision to say, you know what, actually, I'm going to put these drugs and alcohol down. Essentially, what you're saying is, I'm going to walk over broken glass to get to a better life. Yeah. Because there are going to be hard days. And it's that, isn't it? It's like, okay, so if I've been drinking more during COVID, if I've put on some weight during COVID, if I've been smoking too much weed during COVID, but you know what? I'm hearing something today that says, you know what? Let me just make a new decision. No, as you make that decision, you are agreeing on some level to walk over difficult days, to walk through hard times. Yeah. But God, know that you can.
Yeah.
Hey, know that you can if you understand what your values are, and that if you learn the practice of taking a breath and pausing and asking yourself, is this going to take me towards what I want more of, towards more of what matters, or is this going to take me away?
Yeah.
You know? And then getting your friends right around you on that.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
You know? And then it's not about, well, not about getting and acquiring things. Yeah. Then it's about my internal values actually being what navigates, you know, what enables me to navigate my way through this life, huh?
Yeah.
You know?
I think it's so important because at times I've had to ask myself, how badly do you want this?
Mm.
How badly do you, how many no's do you need to hear?
Till you get
how
your
many
yes.
times do you need to be told, nah, that's not, no, this is not for you, and no, not here, and unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Now, how many times, how badly do you want this?
Yeah.
And I think for me, life, and it doesn't matter what age you're at, you know, you just want to live life.
Yeah.
And being able to do that without being under the influence or without being impacted by what your environment dictates to you. Because I think quite interestingly, as Black women, we sit here and we understand and, you know. But when I talk to sometimes the young Black boys and have that conversation with them, that's what it's about. I need to trap. I need to sell drugs. I need to sell weed. Mm-hmm. And it's because their environment has just dictated that to them.
Yeah.
It becomes too easy. So unfortunately, we've got to, you know, the narrative when we're talking about, you know, whether it's young Black boys or young white boys, whoever it is, drugs don't discriminate. You know, there's drug dealers of all different types of colours. But specifically when we talk about our community, it's knowing, you know, I can talk about the Black community and it's coming. Now, if you're a mother of a drug dealer who comes home and then there's just a pile of money on the table and you go and pay your bills with it, you've got a hand in knowing what's happening with that money, right? Mm-hmm. You've got to know exactly what's happening. I've had these same conversations with the Muslim community and where it's the fact of if your son is selling drugs, now whether he takes them or not himself, know that where that money comes from, that's you help accountability. So it's, you know, we hear it and we get to say it takes a village, but this is more than, you know, it's about, you know, the generational and the systematic, you know, the way how it's been just embedded, that's what we look like, that's what's okay. You know, there's a lot more that we can obviously look at, you know. And I think getting help I like to, so it's quite interesting. I deal with preventative drugs and alcohol. Mm-hmm. Cherry's got her hands dirty on the other side of it, you know, when we talk about rehabilitation and addiction and stuff. So we come from the same place of knowing that had we have had this information before, what, where would we have been? What would our lives would have been like? But the reality is that using that as a way to harness onto my own healing, because every time I do a drug and workshop, alcohol, I kid you not, I love it. I love the kids, how they engage with me and how they come back. And I'm like, you ain't never going to remember my name, but you're going to remember what I said to you.
Yeah.
You're going to go back and tell your parents how they're drinking too much alcohol, because only two units and they're not going to like me. Yeah. But, you know, it's more, really more how we decide to impact our community within that, and it starts at all levels. So yeah, we're doing
it. As you're talking, I'm just like, oh, so people are caught up in the idea, absolutely caught up in the idea that this money, this car, this clothing, this label, this girl, this boy makes me valuable, worthy human being.
Yeah.
I'm fundamentally flawed.
Yeah.
Now, I almost anything else beyond that, like from your inner fundamental misunderstanding, everything that follows from that is going to be misunderstood, right?
Yeah.
Everything from that is going to be mistaken. But what we know is they're all innocent in it. So to the kid, it looks like, you know what, I need this, I need that, I need the other to be somebody in the world. It's like, okay, we get why you think that way. And you are mistaken, because hear what? That thing over there has got no power till you give it you, and then it has power. Now, like, so even as you're talking, I'm like, nah, man, I don't want to talk about the young people, anything other than that, other than to make them know that, that actually this is how the mind works, this is how the energy works, that actually, so I've worked in 12-step rehabs for a long time, and I'm not a 12-stepper, right? But one of the phrases that you hear is, you know, it works if you work it.
Yeah.
And I'd be like, okay then, it works if who works it? So the program is there upon the wall. Is the program written there on the wall saving your bacon right now? You know what's working the program? You.
Yeah.
So if you are running a program that says this drugs, this money, this thing, that thing is going to like fix me, that I'll be the man, I'll be the one, and I'll be somebody, then guess what? The program that you're working is working for you. So we are always running a program. The question is, what program are you running? And you think that your independence is in running that program? I don't think so. So when they lock you up and keep you backside in jail for a long time, whose program are you running now? Who is running who? So like the fundamental misunderstanding of things outside of me change what's inside of me.
That's the first
kind of mistake, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, and everything from that then is erroneous. So, you know, I'm listening to you talking, thinking, wow, we have to do something.
I'm telling you, if this hasn't started something already, it really, really has.
Yeah.
It really, really has. Yeah.
And I'm just, I mean, I'm excited that we're able to have this conversation and create this safe space. And I'm all for changing the narrative and creating safe spaces, because until a safe space is created for these things to be talked about, we're going to be talking about them behind closed doors. They're going to be hush-hush conversations. They're going to be under-the-table conversations, and bringing them to light like this, I mean, really exposes our flaws and exposes our resiliences as well, because that's what I really want to tap into, that there really is something strong about us as a community that does not necessarily have to roll with the narrative of drugs and alcohol and addiction and prison and being a statistic. And that's what we seek to change with this narrative. So I'm really excited that we've had this conversation. And I mean, taking it from your viewpoint and what you have experienced, I grew up in a different culture and this is all new to me. So I'm excited. I really hope we can have like 10 more conversations about this, because this is loaded. Phew. Vanessa said, what is your why? And Terry said, what do you expect your well-lived life to look like? I mean, and are you moving towards achieving that goal or moving away from it? Are you moving towards what's important or moving away from it? And I'm really looking forward to having more of these discussions and creating this safe space for everybody to just say that listen, I'm struggling and I need help, and I heard you talk about it, and I really want to let the world know that it's okay for me to say that I have a problem, or it's okay for me to say that I don't know where to find help, but I've heard you, and I mean, this is exciting. I don't even have the words to say it. I'm just
it's interesting excited. Having someone that looks yeah. like you to make you understand mm-hmm. about your issues, or and that it's okay, yeah. you know? Like, it's interesting. Like, people say to me, oh, have you been to university? You speak really well and stuff and things like that. And then I say to them, oh, actually, I didn't finish school because I was a brat and I didn't go to college and, you know, whatever. But that hasn't defined who I am. So you exactly. don't always have to walk the road that somebody else tells you to walk down. Yeah. But the reality is, whatever road you walk down, just know why you're walking it, yeah. you know? Know that there's a road called addiction. Yes. yeah. Know that there's a road called, you know, so many different things. It could be a road of addiction, it could be a road of success, it could be a road of family, it could be, or there's a journey that every single one of us is going to go on. You just have to know why you're doing that journey, yeah. you know, and that makes the decision point yeah. so much easier.
Yeah. Yeah.
Decide, you know, I say to people, you've decided, yeah. decide that that's what you want, go for it and just make it happen, you know, and yeah. I think that behind anything else is just the awesome way to look at it.
I'm excited that we have the safe space to talk about these important decisions, and I'm excited to go on this journey as well. And it's all new to me, but this is great. And thank you so much, Vanessa. Thank you, Cherry.
Thank you.
I've just been so inspired today. No words.
Well, no, this has been absolutely amazing. Is yeah. this like, this is my first official podcast?
Mine as well.
Right, yeah, Cherry's a professional.
No, I've done two.
So we're all like podcast newbies, but I think, yeah, there's definitely a voice to be heard,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
a voice to be heard.
Yeah. So thanks again. This has been This Is My Lockdown podcast. And we're creating safe spaces and changing the narrative and breaking the stigma around mental illness and mental health in our Black and Afro-Caribbean communities. My name is Angela Kumar. This is
Vanessa Kelly.
And I'm Cherry Gillings. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.